We've had on a number of gentlemen from his industry on this program previously. This is, of course, the show where nothing is off topic. So whether we're getting into sports or politics or pop culture or anything like that, we've always had a place on this show from day one for the world of pro wrestling. We know how many of our viewers out there are wrestling fans, and this man has had really an extraordinary career. He was somebody who he first really came into the big time in what you might call the golden age of tag teams here in the mid to late 1980s, when there were so many great ones that were proliferating. And as a part of the fabulous Rougeau brothers, he was right there in the middle of it. He's also known, you can find us pretty easily on the internet, especially YouTube, one of the most legendary off-camera brouhahas of all time. We're not going to get into too much of that with him tonight because he's told the story very well other places. We might get into one or two ancillary aspects of life on the road and what this kind of tells us about the so-called brotherhood out there and the way that sometimes folks get treated from time to time on the road. He is also somebody who's one of the very few wrestlers to ever gain a clean pinfall on Hulk Hogan. He has been an Intercontinental Champion and a World Tag Team Champion. I speak, of course, of the one and only Jacques Rougeau. Jacques, welcome to the FDH Lounge tonight, sir. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's nice to be here.
I should ask at the outset, sir, are we conducting this rule under Quebec province rules, whatever they may be?
Very funny. You could call me Jacques, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
If you could pronounce my name well, it's like Jacques, like the diver there, Jacques Cousteau. Well, it's Jacques Rougeau. So, but please call me Jacques, Rick. We'll make this a personal friendship here.
Wonderful. Well, it's a pleasure to have you on, Jacques. It's really our pleasure to get to do this. And you know, you of course known as Jacques Rougeau at other points in time along the way, a Mountie, a Quebecer, an amazing French Canadian. Let's go back to the Quebecer thing for a second here. I don't think that was ever spelled out on camera exactly what those Quebec province rules were the night that you guys and Johnny Polo got the World Tag Team titles. That was an interesting way to do a title switch.
I'll tell you, it was very funny because it was my first night back. Coming back from the Mountie, which that character I had for over two or three years, working my way up with the final confrontation, the jailhouse match with Big Boss Man. But then I took a year off, and when I came back, I met this guy in Puerto Rico. He was a guy from my hometown, from Montreal, and I liked the way he wrestled. He was a big guy, and I was used to tag team wrestling most of my career with my brother Raymond. And so I called Vince up, and I said, Vince, I said, I think I got a guy here that I'd like to come back with as tag team, because he's big guy, strong guy, and I'm doing all the high flying, but this guy is pretty big, and he flies around too. And so the next thing you know is he had us come in on Monday Night Raw against the Steiner Brothers, the first night in on September 13th, 1994, I believe it was the date. And the first night we came back, we had no idea what was going on. We just thought we were going to come and do a first appearance as a tag team. And the next thing you know, it was when we got in the dressing room, we saw on the card, on the paper, on the sheet, on the wall, that we were in a title match with Johnny Polo as our manager, as Quebec rules, which meant there was a no disqualification rule. Actually, it was you were not allowed to go up on the top rope. There was a bunch of stipulations that Vince had put together, which made us. Made one of the Steiners lose his mind at one point, and I can't remember exactly the rules, to be honest with you, but it was so much a stunning surprise for us to win the WWF titles on our first night back. But what a great moment. And the funny thing about that is I remember coming back to Montreal, and the Montreal newspapers, it was funny because we were expecting a big welcome back as tag team champions, but it was like it was saying the bleu blanc rouge, which means the blue white and red, a black eye for the blue white and red, because we had come in with the Montreal Canadiens jersey on, and with the Quebec flag, and it was funny. The Canadiens were insulted, not the Canadiens, the fans, but the hockey team, the Montreal Canadiens, and so they said a black eye for the Montreal Canadiens. Like what an insult for the Montreal Canadiens for these guys to have the Canadian shirt on, but what an experience it was.
Oh, it really sounds like it. I mean, I didn't remember that that was your first night back in. That's tremendous. You mentioned something kind of in passing, and I'd like to expand on that a little bit here. For the benefit of anybody in our audience who maybe doesn't follow as much some of what goes into really the artistry of pro wrestling and how you approach these kind of things, you talked about having a partner who is bigger than you, who worked a different style. It's very interesting because I hadn't thought of it this way before. I mean, obviously, I know that he was bigger and worked a different style, but when you came up in the Federation the first time, it was you guys, Killer Bees, Strike Force, Can-Am. You had a lot of guys who, I'm not going to say interchangeable, but worked similar styles. Then on the other side, you had the Hart Foundation. Maybe once in a while, you would have a tag team made up of two guys who work differently. So you actually really, as I think about it here, kind of got to see both sides of that because you and Raymond really worked very similar styles here. Then you come in with Carl Ouellette working the tag team later on with him. So was there a style that you preferred? I mean, obviously, I know you love tagging with your brother, but as far as being alike or being different from your partner, was there a preference that you had?
There definitely there was nothing like working with my brother, because my brother and I, we'd been wrestling together for like 10 years before we came to the WWF, and we had a long run together in the province of Quebec, and it's true something about brothers that there was something about us that we had worked so much together, and we knew each other not only in the ring but outside the ring. So we knew if anything happened, how the other one would think. So at different times, different moments, there was a time where we weren't sure of what would happen, but knowing him, the way he would react made me react the right way. I don't know if you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
There's just something about knowing your partner, and my brother Raymond and I, we had a style, a kind of a... The first 2 years from 85, 86, we were the good guys, the Rougeau brothers, and then we became the fabulous Rougeau brothers with Jimmy Hart, who, when we turned heel, it was something that, it was funny because, in a way, because we became almost like two nerds, but at the same time, in real life, I consider myself a little bit nerdish anyway, so it was like, it was easy for me to take that character, because I always laugh for nothing and say some stupid things once in a while, and so it was a character that I really enjoyed, and working with my brother, I think my brother was the same way too. You know, I'm not going to say I'm a very, very smart guy in life. I'm not going to say I'm a nerd either. I'm just like in between there, you know. And but working with my brother and coming with the mentality of where we were coming from, translating from French to English, and coming with just the way we were brought up. Different cultures are brought up different ways of thinking. There's, even if you just go back to when you were young, I don't know if you had Danielle Boone when you were young. Have you ever heard about Danielle Boone?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, okay. Well, anyway, there's different customs, different philosophies, different ways of thinking that you're brought up in. And when my brother and Raymond and I, we came in, we had this automatically, I guess, Vince, when he turned us as some kind of nerdish heels with the small American flag laughing at you guys saying Happy Independence Day when it was Thanksgiving Day. And he had fun with that, but I think he really came inside of us and got our real character. And that was fun. Working with my brother Raymond was something very extraordinary, because here in Montreal we were legends, and I'm not saying that to be bragging. I'm just saying it's the fact, because we're third generation, and we knew our wrestling since we were young, but we really gained the confidence and the support of the Quebec people, at a point where we were like their idols. They'd see us on TV every week, and it was in a Quebec TV that we'd see every week. So going from that, turning heel and adapting the same philosophies, the same way, I don't think they'll... There was something about Raymond and I who a lot of teams, I think, they didn't have. Like, if example, without diminishing anybody, if you take the Killer Bees, Jim Brunzell was Jim Brunzell and Brian Blair was Brian Blair. They put them together. Tito Santana was Tino Santana, and Ricky Martel was Ricky Martel. It wasn't guys that had spent their life together. You know what I mean? Like, so a lot of times they put teams together like that, which... They had made a nice team. They wore the same suits, but they didn't have the same family blood, the same thinking. You understand what I'm saying?
Right. No, I mean, that's a very good point. As far as the origins of how you turned heel, as you alluded to there, I had seen a quote, I think it was attributed to you on the internet, of where you mentioned that Vince seemed to think that fans were having a harder time getting behind two French-Canadian guys beating up on Americans. I have to say, looking at it through the prism of adolescence, so maybe this is a little fuzzy, but at the time, I don't remember that being the case. Seemed like you guys were fairly popular. I didn't seem to recall anything like that. Now, the Honky Tonk Man, yeah, he was kind of getting farted on from day one in that gimmick, and they had to turn him heel. But I don't remember there being any particular urgency to turn you guys heel.
There was just something. There was two things possible. The way I looked at it, it was because I felt like we weren't becoming number one stars as baby faces. But then on the other hand, we didn't have the pen behind us. The big boss wasn't writing the scripts for us to come in and become the world champions. And we were middle class wrestlers, a great team to put on a card to entertain the people. My brother and I never left anybody unsatisfied, but we never had that big push. And I think that's what made a difference. I've learned that now as being a promoter for 10 years myself. I have some talent sometimes that's a better talent, but not at the right place at the right time. Example, I remember when my brother quit in 1989. We'd been there for like 4 years together, and we were just in line for the titles. And there came in from nowhere Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard. And it was like because of a business deal with WCW, or not WCW, but where they'd come from. They just came right in front of us, and those 4 years of hard work, it was just like, how can I say that? Politics sometimes in wrestling make things happen that a lot of guys are they can't take it anymore. Like, they wait for the chance. And I know personally, to be honest with you, as heels, when they turned us heels, we had a lot better opportunity. Thinking of the great matches we had with the Rockers, Shawn Michaels and Marty Jannetty, and thinking that when we go to the Boston Gardens, there's not a hockey team that the NHL hates the most than Boston, than Montreal Canadiens. When we'd go to the Spectrum at Philadelphia Flyers, it was the same thing. Nassau Coliseum in Long Island, it was the same thing. The Montreal Canadiens are just French frogs. It's like, but don't ask me why. Don't know where it originates from, except from the fact that you Americans are so patriotic. I'd say that it was a natural thing. And for me to come in, what a great time I had, because for me, Americans are no better than Canadians at all, and not more Quebecers anyway. And it's always been, I always thought that from the bottom of my heart. And without looking any further, to be honest with you, I remember even right now, if you look at politically speaking in the States, it's not doing too well. You guys are really having a hard time. You're having a recession now for what, 2-3 years now?
Yeah, that's true.
And in Quebec, we're doing fine. We're not having that. We're not having any symptoms of that. I'm going to go as far as going also that when I came in as the Mountie, I had such a great time because the first vignettes I was doing, I don't know if you remember, there were vignettes before a talent would come in the business. Mm-hmm. They'd put like 4, 6, 7 weeks of vignettes. Hey, Mean Gene, soon coming to the WWF, the Mountie. You know, and then they'd show a vignette for about a minute and a half. And the first vignette I made, I'll never forget that time. I was in a park in Montreal, or not far from Montreal, actually in the suburbs. I was in a park and with my horse, and there's this car that pulls up beside me. I don't know if you remember this vignette, but if you've seen it, I guarantee you remember it. There's a car that pulls up beside me, and he says, there's this guy driving the car with his wife in the passenger seat, and he pulls his window down beside my horse, and he says, excuse me officer. And I look right down to him with an arrogant look, and I said, I'm not the officer, I'm the Mountie. So then he looks at me, and then he looks at his wife like, holy shit, we just found a number one here, like, you know, what an number we got here on the horse, you know, and what a weird one, you know. And then he looks back up to me and says, excuse me, Mr. Mountie. He says, can you tell me how to get back to the States? And I just gave him a little wave with my head forward to get out of the car, and I got off my horse, and then I went. As soon as he got out of the car, I asked him to follow me with some arrogant signs in my face, and I had such a great time doing it. And then I got to the front of my horse, and I lifted the whole face, the chin of my horse up, the mouth, you know. And I said, you see this part of my horse? It always points to Canada. And then I turned around, and I went in the back, and I lifted the tail up, and the camera was right there under the tail, and I said, you see this part of the horse? It always points to the U.S. And the guy looked at me, and the camera was so funny, and I had that arrogant look, and the guy said, thank you, Mr. Mountie, thank you, Mr. Mountie, and he got back in his car, and he took off. And that vignette played for actually a couple of weeks around the world, and I could guarantee you when I got to NASA Coliseum and I got to the Spectrum and all those nice places, those friendly places, let's just say I didn't better the relationship between French and English. But anyway, it was a good time. It was Vince's idea, and I thought it was wonderful.
Great vignette, and as far as mentioning that Quebec's economy is doing well and ours isn't in the States, clearly, Jacques, you haven't lost the ability to cut the heel promo over the years here, so that is absolutely accurate as well as that. Something I like to ask you about, when you look at, again, you guys migrating from face to heel here, again, you were part of a very deep face roster at that time, and it was a little harder to stand out from the pack. It seemed like, you know, it was easier for you guys clearly in the heel role there, but a tag team that you worked with on the babyface side, one of the great tag teams of all time, also the British Bulldogs. As I said in the introduction here, anybody can go to YouTube and see this. You've laid out the story in full detail as to what happened.
I'm going to stop you right away.
Yes.
I'm just going to tell you, like you said, the story's been told many times.
Yes.
To be honest with you, in two lines, very fast, I always liked the Bulldogs. I loved the way they wrestled. They were a phenomenon in the ring. I was against the steroids, but it's okay. I kind of enjoyed the way they got over. The people just loved them. And to be honest with you, when I talked to them personally, at the beginning, the first few years, it was they never bothered me. You know, they always played jokes, and they ribbed the newcomers, the younger guys. And they played some serious jokes on some guys, you know, like they had honky-tonk man crying in the dressing room one night on the floor. They had him begging for something, I don't know, but it was embarrassing to see that. A guy that we owe respect to, like a honky-tonk man. And then I'm thinking of a guy that had less time involved in wrestling, if you want, less experience, but I don't know if you remember a guy called Outback Jack.
Yes.
He was traveling in the plane, and the guy was trying to, he was such a nice guy. The guy was trying to get along with everybody, and so the Bulldogs took advantage of that, and they start taking out in bars to make him feel like, hey, you're part of the gang, and as soon as they get in the bars, they start putting pills in their drinks and Alcyon in them, and they'd shave his head off. One night, they shaved his hair off, and they left him bald-headed. That's touching with the gimmicks guy. That's touching with his livelihood, his money, you know. And they put, excuse my language, but they put dog poop in his crocodile in the back of his plane. They put him in the plane the next morning, and it was smelling like all over the place, and he was so messed up with the pills, and they played bad jokes.
Right.
And I never was the kind of guy to laugh at their jokes. I didn't thought it was funny. And they used to take Virgil, they'd take my electric cattle prod, you know, and try to mess around and scare the guys. And it was jokes that I thought personally, or taking a guy's pants when he's in the ring and cutting off one of his legs off, you know, off his pants, and then it's about 20 below zero in Detroit. And the guy would have to come out of the ring, and he only had one-legged pants to go back to his hotel room near the airport. And it was jokes that we didn't need, because we were on the road like 30 days at a time, and we missed our families, we were lonely. It wasn't funny jokes. And when they start playing jokes on me, I told Mr. Fuji the first time it happened. I told Fuji, I said, I'm not going to stand for this. You know, first of all, I was older than these guys. I'd been in the business longer than these guys. Plus, I was the type of guy who didn't play jokes on anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So, finally, the long story short is Fuji went to stooge on me, went to see the Bulldogs, because everybody was afraid of the Bulldogs. They were like the guys in the prison there. You know, the bullies? That's what they were in the WWF. And so Fuji went to stooge to the Bulldogs because he didn't want to be caught up like he was taking sides with me, of course. So when that happened, I came home from Syracuse that night. We spent 3 days at home, and the next 3 days I left my home and I went to Miami, Florida to start another tour. And that's when my father picked me up at the airport in Fort Lauderdale, because my father goes down for, like every Frenchman, when they have an opportunity to go spend 5-6 months down to Florida during the wintertime. And he came to pick me up at the airport to bring me to sleep at his house and take me to the show and spend a couple of days with me. And when he brought me to the arena, they had already been in touch, and so they already knew what was going to happen. So Mr. Perfect, who was, I guess, involved in this whole thing anyway, he sat me. We used to play cards in the dressing room sometimes, the guys, to kill time when we're on last or close to last. We had like 3 hours to wait, so we'd play some cards in the dressing room. And he put my back to the door. And when the time came, I'll never forget, the Bulldogs came in with Cowboy Ace Orton, Don Morocco, the Hearts, Brett, and Davey Boy, and all the brother-in-laws, and there were like 6-7 of them, and they all came in behind me, and I was playing. Like I said, my back was turned to them, and Davey Boy just came and he slapped me on the side of my ear, and I fell off my chair, and I was like all dizzy, and next thing you know, I was being punched in the face. And you said, and I got beat up pretty bad with kicks in the face, and saying, you're going to stooge on me, you're going to tell Vince, you're going to tell Vince, you're going to stooge on me. And so it was like he was actually treating me like I was a guy in school that everybody laughs at, you know.
Mm-hmm.
How do you call a guy in school that everybody laughs at and slaps around? And what's the name of that guy in school you call? You know, a guy that you take advantage of that won't defend himself?
Doofus,
anyway, there must be
a
word in English for that kind of guy.
Yeah.
But anyway, we have some up here anyway. So I was the guy, I guess, that they were just going to insult, embarrass, and play ribs on me, and I was supposed to think that was funny. And I guess they didn't know me. And they didn't know my brother. They didn't know my family. They didn't know my uncle, my great uncle, and all the generation of the Rougeaus. We don't play with anybody's things. We don't rib anybody's things. We don't joke around with people's belongings. But we certainly are not going to let ourselves pushed around. And when that happened, then I took my beating. I remember when I got up from my beating, I was so swollen up in my face you couldn't recognize my face. And I told the agent, Jack Lanza, Black Jack Lanza, came to see me that night. He said, Jacques, he says, you're not going to work. I was supposed to go work with the Heart Foundation, the guys that came in the dressing room, Brett and Jim. And I told Black Jack Lanza, I said, I'm sorry, but I'm going in the ring. I'm going to do my job. So I went in the ring all swollen up, and I did my job, and I came back out, and I got in the airport the next day. And I didn't talk to my father or my brother for like 3 days. And we used to share rooms together, share cars together. And for 3 days, I wasn't talking to anybody. I was thinking of quitting the business. And finally, I decided that, nope, I'm not going to ruin my life. You know, I got to make a comeback here. I just got to take care of myself. So about a week later, I called my dad back in Florida. And I told my father on Sunday night, I said, tomorrow's TV tapings, and I said, in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I said, I'm going to make my comeback. And my father, who hadn't got news from me for a week, but saw me when he brought me to the airport, how messed up I was. So he said, listen, he says, I'm going to give you one advice. He said, those guys are on steroids. Those guys are, they're gone. He says, they're so strong and everything. He says, I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. Because my father was a real tough guy. My father was a lot tougher than any of the Rougeaus. He was 6'4", 240 pounds when he was young, and he was a real fighter. He was as much good as a boxer, as a doorman in nightclubs. He was a tough guy, my father, but always very polite and very nice and very well-respected. But he, another one who just didn't let being pushed around. And the reputation of the Rougeau in Quebec was so important. And the news had already gone everywhere that I got beat up in the WWF. So my father said, before you go to TV tapings tomorrow morning, he said, stop by the bank. And he says, go get yourself a roll of quarters. And he says, put it in the bottom of your hand. And he says, when you hit him, he says, hit him as hard as you can. Hit him in the face. And so that's what I did. And it was funny because for the whole week before I did my comeback, I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I lost about 8 pounds. I was so much afraid of getting beat up again. You know, it was amazing to think what I went through just to save the reputation of the family. So it wasn't something that I enjoyed. It's not something I enjoy talking about today. It's something that was a bad time in my life. But I'm just proud that I came out of that with saving my face.
Well, that really was quite an adventure that you went through. You kind of anticipated my next question perfectly here as far as the nature, because you delineated some of the things that went down, and it's a thing where it's easy to look at an industry from the outside, but there are a lot of things that, and again, it goes beyond the Bulldogs, but it's amazing how many stories I hear that seem to have Calgary roots somewhere in there. It seems like in Stampede they learned a lot of this stuff back in the day, but I think a lot of people would describe it as barbaric. You're cutting up people's clothes, you're drugging them, you're whatever. I mean, it's easy to say that from the outside, but as somebody who lived it, saw it done to other people, and tasted a little bit of it yourself, I mean, is barbaric too strong of a word for some of the things that happened in this so-called brotherhood?
Well, I got to tell you, so much happened, but, you know, a lot of good things came out of that, though, I got to tell you. For example, a guy like Hulk, Hulk Hogan, who he was everybody's hero. He was actually an icon. And I got to tell you, when that happened with the Bulldogs, he was very happy when I did my comeback, because a lot of people don't know this, but when we'd go from airport to airport, and the Bulldogs would come in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning from nightclubs and come in at 6:30, 7 o'clock to grab the next flight for the next town the next day, and going around the airports. And I want everybody, all the fans, to excuse my language, but just to put you in perspective, they were coming in the airport like, oh, fuck these, fuck that. Hey, motherfucker, don't look at me like that, motherfucker. And they were really obnoxious bullies. And Hulk had such a great image. He had such a nice image, and tell the kids to do your homework and take your vitamins. And Hulk, I'll tell you what, he had it, brother. He had something that made you think the fans. It's funny because it all goes back from to explain to the fans a little bit how it is when an icon like that comes really extraordinary with charisma like that. It's because he would even come in the dressing room with the boys, and we were all like so impressed and wouldn't want to say the wrong thing or just wanted to look sharp. And we were so like, oh, we're in the same room, and he's with us tonight. He's on the card. Yes, there's going to be a lot of people. He was a phenomena. And for him to come after what had happened with the Bulldogs when I did my comeback, and to come and give me a slap on my butt and just say, good brother, and for 2 years or I don't know how many years after, like maybe 5 years later, he came into the Molson Center in Montreal and gave me the 1-2-3 pin on him. I think that goes back to that. That goes back to the respect that he gave me. That he and I had. I don't know if you remember Terry Taylor.
Yes.
But Terry Taylor came up to me when that happened, and he came and sat beside me, and he says, "You know what, Jock?" He says, "You just did what I would have wanted done a long time ago." He says, "You just did what a lot of guys wanted to do, and but if only they knew how hard it was and how." It wasn't fun, you know. I'm not a fighter in real life. I'm a character. I'm a good going. I mean, I like joking, and it's not me. I'm not a guy who believes in my character and thinks I'm badass in real life. It's not it. It's we're characters. We're comedians. We're athletes, and some of the guys they grow to believe in their own character, and it makes it hard. But anyway, I think Hulk had the greatest respect for me, and a lot of the guys grew to have a lot of respect for me after that. A lot of guys came and told me once the Bulldogs had left the territory, because they quit 2 weeks later, and it was like, for me, it was so scary because I was so much afraid of a comeback. Like, you know, it's incredible. You have no idea how back-to-back Raymond and I, we came into the arenas in Tucson, Phoenix, everywhere, and just looking behind us to see if we're going to get a baseball bat in the head. It was very hard times. Yeah.
Well, I have to ask you, and it's very interesting that you drew the connection there with Hulk Hogan, and that was one of the things that led him to do the honors for you. That's I hadn't heard that that supposition previously, and I'm very interested, and I know our viewers are, to hear that as well. But another aspect of the story, too, I always kind of wondered about this, and just coincidental, it was at the Survivor Series. When you guys had that final mega tag team match, five tag teams on either side and going at it, 9 years before the Survivor Series in Montreal, I can't help but wonder, based on some of the stories I've heard, was it almost kind of a precursor as far as that goes? Because the story that I heard was, the Bulldogs thought you guys were going to be in the match till close to the end, and that if Tom Billington wanted a PC, maybe he'd have a chance in the locker room. And, of course, I've heard you tell the story. You guys were one of the first ones eliminated. Vince had you leave without even showering, and you were in the next county, at least, by the time the match was done.
Yeah.
Was there a little bit of chicanery there as far as what the Bulldogs thought was going to happen?
I think that, to be honest with you, I think that Vince did the right thing. I think that there could have been a scrabble after the match, to be honest with you. But then again, I wouldn't have let my arms down.
Sure.
But to be honest with you, when Vince came to see us earlier in the evening, he put us in the match together, and he says, "Do you guys mind if we do this?" And I said, No, not at all. And I remember when he put the first he called us all together to put the first spot together. It was so funny because he says, "Okay," he says, "so Davey boy," he says, "I'm going to start with you, Jacques." And I said, "Okay." And then he said, "I'm going to, you're going to grab a headlock on me." He says, "You're going to give me a tackle." He says, "You're going to hit the ropes." He says, "I'm going to drop down." And he says, "When you come off the other side, I'm going to press you at the end of my arms." And he says, "I'm going to lean on the ropes." And he says, "Your brother's going to come in. I'm going to throw you on him." And of course, like everybody in the whole building or in the whole dressing room knew when he said that he thought in my mind, which had crossed it, that when he picks me up and presses me and he hits the ropes backwards, that he's going to drop me on my neck. Said that he dropped me or slipped or whatever and dropped me on my head on the cement floor. But the funniest thing is he didn't have time to finish his sentence and said, "I'm going to press you up there," and he says, "I'm going to lean on the ropes and then I'm going to throw you on my brother, on your brother." And when he says brother, I said, "Hey, that sounds good."
Uh-huh.
And it's like I confronted him right then, like, "Hey, I'll give you my body. I don't have a problem with that. Because what happened between us, you are wrong. Whatever, everything that came upon you in this story, you were wrong. You came looking for me. I never looked for trouble." So when I told him, "Sure, no problem." And when we did the spot, it was so funny because Then they went along with the match, and Vince had came and saw us earlier than that, or I can't remember if it was before or after, doesn't matter to me, but he had asked me, he says, "Jacques," he says, I want you guys," he said, "as soon as you're eliminated the match," he says, "I want you guys to come back," he says, "would you mind taking your bags and not showering?" And he says, "take your things and go back to the hotel." So he said, "the Bulldogs are going to look good in front of all the boys. They're going to look like they could have made a comeback, or they would have made a comeback, and it's going to give them some." It was something like in that kind of like giving back their self esteem of themselves, and I looked at my brother Raymond, and I didn't mind at all, to be honest with you. I wasn't the guy who was looking for altercations, but if he never would have came and told me, I would have done the match. But now the opportunity was there, and I told him, and he asked, and Vince really came up with this idea to save face, I guess. I don't know why, to save face for them and for the whole situation, maybe just because Vince didn't want nothing to happen anymore. There was enough bad things that had happened. So I said, "Yeah," I said, "I don't have a problem with that." And my brother looked at me, and we both thought the same way at the same time, like, "Hey, it's okay. We'll do it. So if that's what you want, Vince, we'll do it." So we got back in the dressing room. I didn't rush. I didn't run. I came in the dressing room, took my things, put them in my bag, and we went back out the car, and we left. And that was it.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's just one of these things where, truth really is stranger than fiction when you start getting into some of these stories of life on the road and everything that had happened in the course of an illustrious career. As far as some of the things you're doing now, I know that you'd mentioned the promoting. I know there's the wrestling school as well. I don't know if I can believe Wikipedia. I learned the hard way one time. We had Buddy Landell on the show, ironically somebody else from your industry. When I quoted him on there, I said, oh, I understand your next independent film is going to be one with Hilary Swank. And he said, oh, somebody was making fun of me and hacked my Wikipedia page. So I don't ever take these things as 100%, but I did read something interesting about you, that one of the things that you're up to is doing some work with a hedge fund dealing with spot electricity up in Canada. Is that one of your present things as well?
Say that again. I don't understand what you mean. I'm sorry. I'm doing some. What kind of work you
say? Yeah, I'm just going to quote you. He also runs a small commodity hedge fund specializing in Canadian spot electricity. Is that accurate?
No.
Wow. So you got hacked too. Okay.
I'll tell you what I do.
Okay.
I'll tell you what I've been doing for the last 10 years. And after I beat Hulk Hogan, and then I quit the big leagues. I came home. I opened up a gym. And I got myself in my gym here in Rodden, in a small town of 10,000 people about an hour away from Montreal. I came back to my kids and my wife. And after doing about 2 months of that, 3 months of that, maybe from 9 o'clock in the morning till 5 o'clock at night, punching my card in the gym, I realized I wasn't satisfied with my life. It's not the kind of guy I am. And my life wasn't over. Just because it was over with the WWF, it was over with the big leagues. I didn't like the sour that we left behind us, the bad taste we left behind us. I started my own wrestling school in 99. And I started in 2000, actually exactly in 2000, I started running my own shows. And I started this new kind of wrestling. If you go, actually, I suggest everybody, I got to do, before I go any further, I got to say thank you to Vince McMahon. He, if you go on WWE.com, for the last week, I was on the front page of their website. They made a story with me. It's called Where Are They Now? And if you go see this segment, go on WWE, go on research, and go see Where Are They Now? And put the Mountie. And explains to you my whole career with them, and he explained this, what I'm going to explain to you now, which is something I think you're going to be very pleased to hear. He gave recognition to my business around the world in the last week. And what I do, I started this business 10 years ago where I have a wrestling show, but it's called Jacques Rougeau's Family Show. I took the word wrestling out of there. When they have Jacques Rougeau's Family Show, they know Jacques Rougeau is wrestling. But because of my show, I don't like what I've seen in the last years on TV, the girls, the I don't know how to say it, the tits, the sex, the violence, the everything that it's turned to, the beer in the ring, the sleeping with the other guy's wife in the ring. For the last 8 years, I forbid my kids to watch wrestling on TV. Mm-hmm. And I changed this whole new image. And my wrestling show was 10 years ago when I first started this. It was so funny because I had such a hard time. I was going into companies selling my tickets, and I was telling you, listen to this. I'm doing a wrestling show. But there's no kicks and there's no punches. There's no girls in the show. There's no beer in the arena. There's no blood, of course. And it's funny because I had 200 people in an arena that holds 2,000 people. I had 200 people. I was losing money. But I believed in my characters. I believe in matches like the Rockers and the Rougeaus and even without the kid. I believe in taking the 4-year-old kid to come see wrestling and to come see the midgets, to come see Spider-Man, Zorro, the Giants. I have Giant Kurgan in my shows for the last 7 years, who did the movie Sherlock Holmes, I'm sure you've seen, and the movie 300. He's in my shows for the last 7 years. I'm actually the one who gave him his role in the movies. Warner Brothers came to Montreal. They called my school looking for some guys. Because it was filmed in Montreal, the movie 300. And I'm the one who got his first role. And from now, he's got 4 roles. He's got 2 more coming up with Antonio Banderas and Mickey Rourke. He's doing a big movie with him, too, coming up. He's gone for the glory. But long story short is I took all these characters, and there was absolutely no violence. There was good guys and bad guys. There was high spots. There was a lot of expression, a lot of interaction with the people. But there was no fingers up in the air. There was no, hey, you fat lady, you look ugly, and there was none of that. All the script was written down like a Broadway play. Every move that was made, I wrote. Every word that was said, I wrote. And the first tour I did in 2000, like I was having 200-300 people, a lot of people were saying after the show, Jacques, I know there's not a lot of people here tonight, but don't quit, it's a good thing. And then the year after, I had like 500 people. And then I went to 1,200 people. I went to 1,500 people. The last 5 years, my business, if you go see JacquesRougeau.com, you'll see all this. I got a great website, JacquesRougeau.com. For the last 5 years, I've been selling out my arenas. At Christmas, it's 4,000 people. During the season, it's like 2,000, 3,000 in the arenas around the province of Quebec, but it's all sold out. I've been doing really well with my company, and Vince, what he did last week, he gave me recognition of everything I'm telling you now. He put it on his WWE website. I could not believe it. I had the Montreal newspapers yesterday write about the WWE giving me some credit of what I'm doing. And I believe, I honestly believe, if you go back in the first days, when we'd go to a TV day in the WWE, and we'd get there at 11 o'clock and we'd want to see who are we working against. Then we'd see in the card and then we'd ask the agents, what are we doing tonight? They say, well, we're going in a meeting at 1. There were about 10, 12 guys, Chief J. Strongbow, Pat Patterson, so many guys that would go into the meeting, Tony Garea, I'm naming them, I'm missing them all. And they'd go into a meeting and they put their heads together. And there were about 10 guys with Vince, and they were thinking of every script they would do every match. And it would take them like 4 or 5 hours. And around 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, they'd come out of that meeting, and then the agents would come and see us, and this is what we're doing, this is what we're doing. And there was no chairs and no blood and no screw yous and fingers and this and that and violence and girls undressed. And it was accessible to kids that were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old that wanted to go find a hero. Coco Beware with his bird, Jake the Snake with his snake, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, Macho Man with Miss Elizabeth, who had so much class. Hulk telling everybody, take your vitamins and do your homework. It was awesome. It was the good days. And what I'm doing now, I'm producing all this now. After 10 years, I'm having sellout crowds everywhere. People know me now, and Jacques Rougeau family show is known across the province so well now. And I'm doing it without kicks. I'm trying to imagine a match where there's no kicks and no punches. And the funniest thing is, when we finish our show, I do about an hour and a half show, there's no intermission either. It's like, and I come in with the big lights when I was in the WWE. Big spotlights on top, the big square lights. I got the big gorilla at the exit of the Zamboni where they clean the ice, the smoke, the whole big schmoz. But family-orientated. It's more like a Walt Disney kind of show. And after the show, when it's all done with, it's amazing because the kids from 4 years and older, they fall in love with the characters. And then when they get by the ring, all the wrestlers after the show, they go around the ring, and for a full hour, I have all the talent stand around the ring, and I always have the company, all the corporate tickets that I sold in companies, I always tell them, you bring your own camera, it doesn't cost a dime, and your kid comes around the characters that you'll see on JacquesRougeau.com, go see my characters that I created, and they come around them, and they take him with around the waist, the giant picks him up, the midget smaller than the kid, they take these pictures, and I ask sometimes the company guys who I met myself, because I sold the tickets myself, I go in the companies myself, and I see one of the presidents that I remember seeing selling tickets, and then I ask him, I said, hey, how'd you enjoy the show? No kicks, no punches. How'd you enjoy it? And then he looks at me like he's lost a little bit because he didn't realize there was no kicks and no punches because it's high-flying, it's everywhere, it's so fast-paced. It's and then I tell the guy, the president, I said, hey, how did your kids like the show? And then he looks at me and he says, well, not only the kids, I did too. You know, and so I have a show that touches everybody from 4 to 104 years old. And so I have some video, too. If you go on JacquesRougeau.com, you can see a couple of videos. Go on video, my first page when you come in. Click a few videos, you'll see what I do in my shows. And it's amazing what I've turned out to do up in Quebec here. And for the fact that Vince put that on his website last week, and people were calling me from everywhere, hey, Jacques, did you see on the front page of the WWE.com, you're there. You did. They're showing what you did in the past, what you're doing now, the conferences you give in schools for kids. You know, in the last 5 years, I spoke, Rick, to 30,000 kids in 5 years.
Wow.
I go talk about drugs, steroids, street gangs, cigarettes, the importance of sports, the importance of school, at least up to 12th grade. And then I finish my – it's funny because I finish my hour conference – actually, I should say this, Rick. I start my conference, and I tell the 500, 600 kids that are in front of me, I said, I'll make a deal with you guys. If you listen to my good advice for 45 minutes, and you don't disturb me, you don't cut me off, you don't interrupt me, and you're not rude, you're not impolite, The last 15 minutes of my conference today, I said, you see my big mat in the corner over there? I said, I'm going to pull out the mat here, I'm going to bring it out here, and I want to have your school teachers' names. And then I start beating up the school teachers at the end, power bombs, suplexes,
nice.
And the kids go nuts. But they know, it's amazing, because I can't tell you how much I touch the kids. And what I'm doing now in the province of Quebec is really awesome. It's almost like, for me, it's a Stanley Cup. Every time I go into school, I go out of there, I get letters from the teachers, from the kids, saying, Jacques, you really touch the kids. They feel like you're not trying to be a superstar. You're like them. You know, you're simple-minded like them. You know, you just share experiences and share things that you've seen, and which makes my conference real. And so I'm really feeling good about everything I'm doing. And I want to thank Vince. I hope it gets to him. I hope someone tells him. What he did to me in the last week is like if I work for Pepsi Cola and I go do a conference at Christmas time and I tell everybody after I finish my conference and I work for Pepsi and I say, hey, everybody go have a drink, go have a rum and coke. It's like competitors completely, what he's doing and what I'm doing. And so he put my business in value around the world, and I thank him for that.
Well, that's tremendous that he spotlighted it like that, and that's such good work that you're doing. And as far as the one thing from the Wikipedia page, it's I don't know what it is about wrestlers that makes you guys targets for getting hacked there. I don't know why somebody put the information on there about the hedge fund. Again, it happened to Buddy Landell also. It's unfortunate, but I appreciate you clearing that up and talking about what you're doing presently. Another bit of information, again, we've already established Wikipedia should not necessarily be taken literally, but the one piece of information I'm seeing here as well is that SOS Suicide Janus, I'm probably mangled the name here,
yeah.
Is there
yeah.
a local suicide prevention organization you're affiliated with?
Yeah, exactly. I for the last, actually, not anymore this year, because the last year I've been a spokesman for the new book that the University of Montreal came out. It's called The Youth and Street Gangs, and I promote that when I give my conferences in schools. I give out books that the government gave me to give out. And but 3-4 years ago, actually, there's a group in Quebec that was going around helping kids for the suicidal, and it was called SOS Suicide, which is SOS Suicide. And they asked me because they felt I had a good relationship with the youngsters and a way of speaking. And I went to, in my conferences, I talked a lot about that. I went to talk about even to some grown-up. I gave some conferences about not only, it's not only the kids for them to understand, it's for the parents to keep an eye on the kids. It's sometimes it's something you miss. It's so important about leaving your kid always doing his homework by himself, seeing that he's sad or something, and you just say, oh, he'll be better tomorrow. And I work with SOS Suicide. I was a spokesman for that for 3 years. And you know, Rick, to tell you the truth, I've been in the business 33 years, and I've been in the media and helping playing hockey for a team of the newspapers, getting some funds for the blind, for their dogs, and for all kinds of organizations. I've been doing that for 33 years for the Little Sister, Big Sister. I don't know if you have or I don't know if you have that in the States. It's like a Little Sister or Big Brothers. It's something where the people go help kids that are in need just to have a friend. And there's all kinds of associations like that I've worked throughout my career, and I've never let that go. Even when I was in WWF, it was so funny because I would always come back and get involved with my people at home, and I think that's why today I have such a great respond to the people encouraging me in my new business that I'm doing, my family-orientated wrestling, because they know that I'm working for the society in the ways of helping the kids in schools and helping the parents and kids to share some good time together. Today in our life is so fast, life is so hard, that the father's going to go to work and the mother's going to go to work and the kids are often left by their own, you know, because it's like that in life. It's just we need two incomes now to make it. But the bottom line is I tried to explain to them that if just once in a while you could, instead of dropping your son off at the arena at 9 o'clock in the morning and picking him up at 9 o'clock at night, if you could do some activities with him. Because for me, to be honest with you, Rick, I had one hero in my life, one really big hero. The only hero I really had was my dad. And he always was my hero. He was a wrestler, but he was my hero. He was a tough guy, and he was a promoter, but he was since I was young, he was always my hero. And every time that I go see a wrestling match when I was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, and my father would take me to the Montreal Forum where the Canadians play, but it was a wrestling night that night, or every Monday night at the Paul Sauvé Arena, it was like my biggest moment of the night, because we were 5 kids and we'd all go to the wrestling. And my biggest moment of the night was after the show, to make sure that I ran fast enough to get to the car first, to be sitting between my dad and my mom up front in the car, so I could lean on my dad, you know. And it's amazing. And so I try to tell the parents today that spend some time together with your kids. Come see my show. There's no sex, no violence. There's no drugs. It's a good time. It's a good happening. And those moments that you'll take pictures at the end that you will cherish for 20 and 30 years from now. And the last thing I'll tell you about that, Rick, is really something that really works well for me and for the fans that come to see my shows. It's a new concept, but it's like, when I'm around the ring, sometimes a company guy is going to come with, he has 10 kids with him or a group of 10, and he's going to say to me, "Hey, Jacques, can I take a picture of you and my son?" And then I'll look at him, I'll say, "No way," out of nowhere. And I'm the one who told him to bring his camera that he could take pictures. Then he'll look at me and says, "Well, Jacques, what do you mean, no way? You told me when you sold me the tickets I could take pictures." Yeah. I said, "Hold on. See the man beside you? Give him your camera." I said, "You come beside your son here in the picture with me. So your 5-year-old son here, when he's 25 years old, he's going to remember his 2 heroes. He's going to remember me, and he's going to remember the person who brought him." And it's just a little thing. It's a little detail that makes it that the company say, "Jacques, you thought of everything." You know, so I'm very proud of that.
Awesome. That is, you know, just so incredible the way that you're taking care of the kids there and giving them, like you said, those lifelong memories and, you know, those photos that they will treasure forever. God bless you, Jacques, because this is just good stuff. You're really giving back to the community. You're showing the positive side of the business in such a strong way here. And like you said, you know, I'm glad that Vince went and spotlighted this on the website. It's such good work that you're doing. If there's anything that we neglected to mention about your present activities or neglected to push hard enough, please take it away. We always give our guests a chance to plug thoroughly.
I'm fine.
Okay.
I'm fine. You've been great. I'm happy that you let me speak my piece. And the only thing I could say is JacquesRougeau.com. Go see my website. You'll see all kinds of videos and stuff like that. And but if ever you're up in up north and you're in the province of Quebec, look at the dates of my shows and bring your kids, bring your families to my show. And I have 3 sons right now that are in the business. My 3 boys, which are the 4th generation of the Rougeau family. And they're actually the 3rd generation of Rougeau brothers. My sons, they wrestled together. Wow. And then it's like, that's my heritage. And I'm actually wrestling my last year this year. I've been on a retirement tour starting Christmas. It's going up to next Christmas. I'm going around the province just saying goodbye to all my fans. And my 3 sons are there, which are much better wrestlers than I am anyway. So I'm going to just lay back a little bit, take care of the show, and make sure that I produce a great show. But I'm going to let my kids keep the dynasty of the Rougeaus alive, and I'm set with that, Rick. You're very kind, and you're very interesting to speak to with. I appreciate your comments and your questions.
Well, thank you so much, Jacques. It was a true pleasure, and I feel like even with the time we spent, that we really just kind of got to the tip of the iceberg here. I feel like there's certainly more that we could do. We thrive on having good conversations with people on this show. It was very easy to do so with you, and we would love to do so again anytime, Jacques.
You're very kind, and I salute all my good fans in the United States of America and in Canada. And when I always say that the Mountie always gets his man, and that the Americans are patriotics, and we're good heels, the truth is I have a lot of friends in the United States, and don't mix my character and my real life person. I enjoy the States. I love the States.
Absolutely. I remember a couple of American friends in particular that night at SummerSlam when they threw you in the clink back in 1991. You made some friends in jail there in that skit.
That was a classic.
That was That was memorable. You've given us a lot of memorable moments, Jacques, and it sounds like more are being made every day up in the province there. Appreciate it. Love to do it again sometime.
God rest Big Boss Man's soul.
Yes, yes.
He was a great man, a great, great, great man.
He really, really was, from everything I knew about him. And, of course, you had the privilege of knowing him personally. Thank you, Jacques. I would look forward to doing this again.
Thank you.